Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. It is Tuesday, January 6th. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. Today we hear from Venezuelans living in the islands about the drama playing out across the globe. We learn more about U.S. immigration and customs enforcement in the islands. Arrests and detention spiked in 2025. And we get the latest on Hawaii County's efforts to rein in short-term rentals. We hear from the new chief of ocean safety as he settles into the new role. An Ocean of Peace, a Maui exhibit showcasing Micronesian artists, gets an extended run. Plus, a comedian spent a month observing Kilauea. He hopes his one-hour show about volcanoes will make you erupt in laughter. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. The Venezuelan community in Hawaii is still processing the events in their home country over this past week. Dozens of Venezuelan and Cuban soldiers were killed when U.S. troops seized President Nicolas Maduro and his wife and flew them to New York. Venezuelans here locally say they have mixed feelings about these developments. Rosalie Garcia left the South American country in 2022 because of what she saw as a drift from democracy. She described how those changes came about in Venezuela in an interview yesterday with HPR's culture and arts reporter Cassie Ordonio.
For years and decades now, Venezuelan people have been suffering quietly because the government always cover everything with lies. You know, when somebody is so good lying that they believe the lie to everybody believe them, they love to lie and they always love to manipulate information. And when they are good speakers, everybody will believe them, like narcissist people. And everybody is like that in the government in Venezuela right now. Nicolas Maduro, his wife, Delcy Rodriguez, her brother, Jorge Rodriguez. Everybody in power right now in my country are narcissists. They lie to people and they make up documentation that's not true. They took all the Venezuelan presidential election for them. Talk to the people and make up documentation that they cannot put it up in public international way because they know they cannot support her. So they went lying to the country. After that, I mean, you see how many people left my country. And everybody that left is because they could. The one that could not is because they don't have resources. You know, everybody that left home, they have degrees, they're lawyers, they're engineers, they are medical, they're doctors, and they could leave the country. But people that stay is because they don't have no education at all. And it's easy for the government try to convince somebody that don't have no knowledge about the political or the laws to whatever they want. Anybody that think different, they will put in jail for 25 years without any civil rights, without any opportunity to defend their own self. They took the Maduro and the clan 25 years to mess it up. Maybe they will take us 25 or more to fix it. But when that happens, so we have the right resources and the right people ready to help and support us, we can be better and we can rebuild everything better than how it was before.
Ordonio also spoke with Rafael Coelho, who, like Rosalie Garcia, left Venezuela in 2022. He lived in Las Vegas briefly before moving to Hawaii. A civil engineer by training, Coelho joined the Army to, as he put it, use his degree and career in service of the country. He described reactions to recent events from family and friends back home and what he hopes for the future of his country.
Most Venezuelans are really happy, and we are hopeful that we will see an upcoming transition, a peaceful transition into what Venezuelans already manifested in votes in July 2024. And hopefully they will respect that and we will see a change. There is a lot being said that there is a war, that this is an invasion, that we're going to become a colony. And none of that is true. There is no war. There is no an invasion. There is no fighting. It was just an extraction of an illegal, illegitimate, so-called president that is also a narco-terrorist, head of a cartel drug cartel, and it is a really dangerous person. And although, like I said, it is unfortunate the way it happened, it was the only way Venezuelans, we have fought and going to the streets so many times and protest peacefully, and so many people died, like hundreds of people died. Thousands of people were imprisoned for thinking differently, for speaking up against this regime. A lot of radio stations, news stations were shut down. So it is really, there is a lot going on in our minds right now, but we're hopeful that we will see a change and that we will see a restoration of the democracy and the future that we deserve as a country. After fighting and protesting for so many years, a lot of us gave up and decided to immigrate to other countries. There is a big presence of Venezuelans in the United States, but globally, there is between 7 to 9 million Venezuelans. It is the mass exodus. The overall situation, politically, economically, and socially, forced us to leave, because everybody in Venezuela right now, the ones that stayed, are pretty much in survival mode. They are working hard, making the bare minimum. The minimum wage is on the floor, $3. It is just, there is no way to live that way. So people that are still there rely on the ones that are outside and send them food, medicines, money to keep on and survive. We want Venezuela to remain an independent country like it has always been. And nobody wants to be a colony or an annexation or a territory of another country. We want to remain independent. So that's our hope, that there is peaceful transition, and the election results that we manifested already in 2024 are respected. Or if we need to go into a new election, we will do so too, as long as it's audited and observed and it is the actual will of Venezuelans. We have a group of Venezuelans in Hawaii. There is between 50 to 100 of us. We were trying to spread awareness of the situation in Venezuela, because this is not about being Republican or Democrat, or if you like or dislike the current administration or the current president. This is about what is truth. This is about justice, and this is about the freedom that we as Venezuelans deserve and the new future that we hope to see for all our families and friends. Because of the mass immigration, a lot of families got separated. So we're hopeful that we can come back together and work to rebuild our country. That is our hope.
That was Rafael Coelho, who spoke with HPR's Cassie Ordonio about the recent events in his home country of Venezuela. Honolulu Civil Beat has crunched the latest numbers on arrests and detentions made by Immigration and Customs Enforcement in the islands. Last year's numbers were four times higher than in 2024. The Bureau of Prisons has a contract to use 125 beds at Hawaii's Federal Detention Center for those arrested by Homeland Security, but we've learned that some of those detainees come from other states. Civil Beat's Matthew Leonard joins us this morning to talk about the situation. Good morning, Matthew.
Hey, aloha, Catherine.
Yeah, so I thought it was really interesting that you got the breakdown where a lot of these detainees are from.
Yeah, so you've got, around 110 different nationalities, actually, of people who are, you know, have been in ICE custody or in the custody of DHS right now in the state of Hawaii. And, you know, predominantly those detainees are people from mainland People's Republic of China, Mexico, Guatemala, and Federated States of Micronesia. And then you have a breakdown which goes into, you know, pretty much, you know, a kind of a world tour of other nationalities of people who've, you know, who've been in detention. But the data that we base the story on is, you know, we should say is still incomplete. It only goes up until October 15 of 2025. And there's traditionally a pretty big lag time in the availability of data from DHS. And this was obtained under Freedom of Information law by UCLA's project, and they've kind of released it. And so the next time we'll get an update and get the full year will be mid-March. So the story kind of tries to give a bit, you know, extrapolate a little bit in terms of what we can tell so far from the, you know, from the incomplete numbers. So we certainly will see probably a 35% increase in forced removals from Hawaii. That's if the current pace of deportations, you know, is maintained through till the end of the year when we see the data.
And then what's the sense is how we compare to other jurisdictions?
So interestingly, when this was crunched at the national level, there was a big upsurge, like almost an immediate uptick in administrative arrests after the Trump inauguration in January. And then that all kind of seems to have fallen off. In July through October, there was about half the number of arrests in the second half of the year. Now, we don't have the complete numbers. There were, we know, 44 people arrested on Kauai in November during an ICE raid there. So, you know, we'll probably see, you know, there'll probably be some corrections. But, you know, ostensibly, there was a really significant uptick in terms of the arrests in the first half of the year. And when I spoke to a local immigration attorney, she said that increasingly those arrests are going to be taking place in what they call at large. In other words, people are being detained at places like courthouses when they turn up to appear on non-immigration related matters, but ICE knows that they're going to be there, and that's where they can actually detain people. And also people who have turned up for their routine check-ins with ICE. Previously, people who have been compliant with ICE policy and have checked in, you know, regularly every month or whatever, are now increasingly going to find that they're being detained when they turn up in person at ICE offices.
Yeah, so it's pretty scary, I'm sure, for many of these folks. And then, there is that contract, right, with the Bureau of Prisons for like 125 beds at the facility?
Yeah, at FDC Honolulu. And sure, and so we do have numbers for that, which speak for themselves. There were an average number of detainees in January. Sorry, mid-February, there were about 15 people on average in ICE detention in FDC Honolulu. That number at the end of November was 81. So, you know, you're seeing a really, really significant uptick in the people, because people are being detained. There was a change in ICE policy in July that basically meant that all people going through ICE procedures were going to be detained, and it's much, much harder for those people to be released on bond. And so also FTC Honolulu is being used to house ICE detainees who are being flown from the mainland for various reasons. So you're seeing people cycle in and out of the federal facility in Honolulu who are, you know, under ICE, in ICE detention.
Yeah, I know. It's just a very fluid situation, but really interesting look at the numbers there. But thank you so much, Matthew.
You're welcome, Catherine. Anytime. Thanks.
That was Honolulu Civil Beat's Matthew Leonard talking about his story on ICE arrests. You can read the story at civilbeat.org.
Support for HPR comes from the Hanahaoli School Professional Development Center, specializing in progressive education workshops and teacher education at hanahaoli.org/PDC.
Colombia has a particularly windy stretch of coastline where the government hopes to build a farm for renewable energy.
Como apenas estamos iniciando.
We're just at the beginning, but we're hoping things go well, this woman says. Indigenous groups in Colombia want to make sure they do not get left behind. That's next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Support for HPR comes from Osher Lifelong Learning Institute, with courses for ages 50 and older at UH Manoa, community colleges, and online beginning February 2nd. OLLIUHM.org.
For For years, the states, counties have been trying to figure out how to better manage short-term rental units. On Maui, not one but two lawsuits have been filed over a new vacation rental ordinance that was recently signed into law. Today, we check in with Hawaii County, where a new ordinance that was supposed to go into effect last month was kicked down the road. HBR contributor Betsy Brown has been following the story. She joins us now. Good morning, Betsy.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, so how different is what's happening there on the Big Island, let's say, from, you know, from Maui?
Well, this bill is a lot less consequential, I would say, for the fact that it doesn't limit the number of vacation rentals that can operate, and it also doesn't change any zoning laws or where vacation rentals can operate. But what it does do is it requires all of the temporary vacation rentals, those short-term vacation rentals are defined as a place that's rented for 180 days or less, all of them now have to register. And so the law sets fees and fines for not complying also. But it also clarifies definitions in the law, and it does this by creating categories now for hosted and unhosted rentals. And so the hosted rental definition is new. That's any accommodation located on a property that's also primarily where the host lives. So that can be attached or detached studios in your home, rooms that you rent out, accessory dwelling units on the same property, but also bed and breakfast fall on that category. So this was introduced by council members Heather Kimball and Ashley Kirkowitz. And I asked council member Kimball why she introduced this. And she says, basically, they needed to close gaps that were left in the law.
There are a number of loopholes that people have been taking advantage of. And then secondly, it seems that we have, based on looking at the listings on Airbnb and VRBO, many more operational short-term vacation rentals and hosted rentals than are actually registered with us or paying TAT and the appropriate GE.
So that TAT, that's the transient accommodations tax that guests pay when they come and stay at hotels. They also have to pay that when they stay at vacation rentals. And those uncollected dollars, she says, are a big part of the push for this bill. And an economic study that was done alongside the bill's consideration estimates that the county's missing out on about $12 million a year.
Wow.
Part of the picture is ensuring that we don't have the same pressures as, say, Maui County or Kauai County on the housing market that the number of transient vacation rentals present. So not only do transient vacation rentals take away individual units from the housing market, but they have an overall inflationary pressure on the market itself in terms of rents.
So like we mentioned, the ordinance was supposed to go in effect, Catherine, like December 20th, but it was then extended to July 1st. And basically, the big reason for that is actually to help the county. The county needs more time to get a system in place. And right now, they have an RFP posted for a platform to take in those registrations and also manage and monitor the enforcement. And so while the extension, right after the extension passed, actually, I spoke with Mayor Alameda right before he signed the extension. And I asked him why he supports the measure and also if he thinks the county right now has any idea how many vacation rentals are actually operating.
I think we're making guesses, you know, and that's why this registration process is critical.
Are there any hopes you have for once all this is in place?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I hope to have a better understanding of where these short-term vacation renters are. My hope is that it's in resort areas and not heavily dense populated areas like in residential communities, because that's where it could hurt us. You know, it could hurt us because those rentals could be housing, you know, for our locals.
And yeah. So I also talked with a lot of people who host these short-term vacation rentals. I reached out to people on Airbnb and also just from Facebook community groups. Well, there are a lot of people who don't live on the island who run them. I found a lot of them have some connection, like they have family or they want to return to the island, or some actually live on on Oahu or different Hawaiian islands. And the one, there's also quite a few in the community who live on the property and rent it out. Those are the hosted vacation rentals. And I asked those operators what they think of the bill. None of them wanted to go on the record because it's just such a heated issue. They don't want neighbors or fellow rental owners to be mad at them. And also some of them are operating on agricultural lands that they'll have to get special use permits for now, and they don't want to be targeted for enforcement by the county. But there was one woman who rents out space who says that she's afraid that the renewal fees and the registration fees are going to make it too difficult for her to make a profit. And that's a concern that was raised by several people during council meetings before the bill was approved.
Please stay out of our lives. Like, we're just trying to survive. How many thousands of us have stood up and said, you're wrecking our financial viability. You're taking away our security.
Yeah, but the county just wants the taxes, right?
Yeah, they want that money. And like the mayor says, he feels like there might be a lot of them running that they don't even know are. There might be a lot of people running vacation rentals on land that it actually isn't permitted for that. So they'll have to either close or, you know, find some way to come into compliance. So there's a lot of discussion going on about this, and some people expect, you know, it will lead to more requirements and restrictions. So, of course, a lot of people are upset because of that fear. On the other side, though, I spoke with some bed and breakfast owners, and most of them are fine with the changes, even though they say it actually is going to cost them a little bit more to re-register every year. They say they are already paying their taxes. They're already registered. So they just think that this law will, while it might cost them a little bit more, it'll make everything more fair for them because they're competing with people right now who aren't paying.
Right. Well, we'll just have to see then how this all plays out. But thanks so much, Betsy.
You're welcome.
That was HPR's contributing Big Island reporter Betsy Brown with a look at the short-term vacation rental situation on the island of Hawaii. You can read her story online at hawaiipublicradio.org. Honolulu's new ocean safety chief, Kurt Lager, was just sworn into office. Originally from San Diego, he has spent the last 20 years rising through the ranks as a lifeguard. Hired under Ocean Safety's administrator, Ralph Goto, Lager learned lessons from his time at Makapu Beach. Ocean Safety became its own department in 2024 under Mayor Rick Blangiardi, and Lager stopped by our studios recently to talk about what's ahead for this new department.
We have 291 lifeguards that work for the department, and so our main objective is to prevent aquatic injuries and drownings. The plan going forward is to make sure that we achieve that goal as best as we can. And so we've become our own department as of May of last year. And so going into 2026, I just was able to become the chief of ocean safety. And so I think we're just looking at taking the next steps to really achieve that goal of reducing drownings, especially among keiki. Keiki ages 1 through 15, it's the number one cause of death is drowning. We want to really try to be preventive in our messaging and our actions and what we do, and expand our operations to prevent and then respond to any emergencies.
Yeah, and it's so key that we get families involved so they teach those swimming skills to their kids early on.
Yeah, early swim lessons is super important, I think, and we need to see more of that on Oahu. I think it lacks, and there is a push for that right now, and there's a big demand, especially to try to get it back into the DOE, into the schools, which I think would be great if we're able to accomplish that.
Yeah, I know. I think one of the first schools to require a swimming test before you could graduate was Mid-Pacific Institute, which was awesome, just really raising the bar. And it was really more to help students either get over their fear of water, but just to be able to say, we're going to work with you so that by the time you graduate or long before that, that you have those skills that are vital because we're surrounded by ocean.
Yeah, and just a little bit of education so they know if they do get in trouble or if their friends get in trouble, they know how to get help going in the right way. And there's some great stuff happening out on the west side right now with Nokamakai, and they're reaching out to a lot of the schools on the west side. So I hope this is a good jumping off point for the rest of the island where we can get more swimming education to the keiki.
I know that one change with our ocean safety department is expanding the hours, which is nice because you've got people out there at the break of dawn, right?
Sure.
Because people are in the ocean way before 9 o'clock.
There's people in the ocean overnight as well. And we fully recognize that there is a demand outside the what we call our regular business hours. Right now, we went to a 4 10-hour shifts. So we're working 10-hour days on the beach right now, which is 8 in the morning till 6:30 p.m. And just by doing that, looking at the statistics, we have seen island and statewide, as the other counties have gone on these 10-hour shifts, a reduction in drowning. So I think it's showing that coverage helps. And so now what we got to figure out as a department is specifically, I think, the summer months between April through October, how we're going to expand those hours, those early morning hours, and then into the late towards sunset time. How do we achieve that?
Yeah, I know with the extra coverage, I know you need more parking for your lifeguard. So I've noticed at my favorite beach, there are more lifeguard parking stalls.
Yeah.
Just because, yeah, you're essential. You need to be there.
Yeah. And so you're seeing more parking spots because we're also trying to make sure there's adequate staffing at all our towers around the island. So we've seen increases in the number of guards at each location so that we can fully meet the demands that are asked of us.
And on the west side, I know that you folks have tried to take an approach of being mobile with the jet skis, because I know Electric Beach there by Kahi Power Plant, a lot of people get into trouble over there.
Yeah, and we have a rescue unit that's based out of Kotalina, so it's right there next to Kahi. We've expanded our program a bit over the last handful of years, and we have 9 rescue units around the island that can respond to mobile cases where we don't have lifeguard towers. So when someone calls 911, we have lifeguards sitting in the Joint Traffic Management Center. If you call 911 and ask for a lifeguard because something's happening in the water, you'll speak to a trained lifeguard who can get our response and get help to you as quickly as possible. So we have 9 rescue units now, and that supplements the other 12 other mobile responders who are our lieutenants, supervisors out on the island. But we're looking at expanding, potentially adding more vehicles and jet skis out there as well.
And then I know that they're talking about a emergency response center out there on the North Shore across from
Sharks Cove. Kapo'o, mm-hmm. Yeah, they want to do a first responder hub up there, which we're supportive of. They're still in the process of working out the land deal, I think, with the city. And if that happens, we'd be happy to be part of that. I think it's really exciting.
And then I know that the issue of a headquarters for Waikiki is a kind of a question mark, because we don't know what's going to happen to the natatorium. You folks are staffed over there right now, but during construction, if they decide to rebuild it, you know, that's going to be an issue, right?
Yeah, sure. And so we're facing that issue in several locations. We're looking at facilities around the island right now. So the natatorium is where we house our offices that look over Waikiki and Ala Moana operations. And then our headquarters is over by Kapi'olani Park off Liahi Ave. And so we're starting to outgrow a lot of the buildings that we're in. We used to be under the Department of Parks and Recreation. And so a lot of the places we're in, we've inherited them from parks. And so now we're looking at trying to improve some of the locations or find new locations that we can either build something new or move into as we continue to expand.
And I know since we've started this new year, 2026, there's already been a number of rescues on our beaches.
Yeah, there's quite a few rescues that happen every day. You don't hear about them in the news all the time. They're what we call routine rescues, but there are quite a few that happen, especially this time of year on the North Shore with the surf.
Just looking back at some of your press releases, I know there was a young student from MidPAC, I think, who helped somebody out at China Walls, I think, a rescue there.
Yeah, that was a great one. There was a boat that sank. One of our lifeguard sons actually happened to be out on a jet ski, and with his friend, they were doing some foiling, and they saw someone in trouble, and then they went and tried to find the other guy, and they eventually found him after his boat had sank about a mile offshore and was able to successfully get him and bring him back to shore.
Yeah, and then another lifeguard who was off duty also rescued somebody over on Windward Oahu by the sandbar.
Yeah, out at the sandbar. That was one of our lieutenants, Ryan Moniz. That was just a fantastic story. He just was in the right place at the right time. He was with his 4-year-old son on his jet ski, and he saw something that didn't just quite look right. And I think that's that lifeguard instinct that kicks in. And he went over, and sure enough, there was a bystander doing CPR on a lady that had drowned in that area. And while Ryan was there, he initiated and took over CPR and got her back breathing and conscious.
And to think that he was off, but really lifeguards are never off.
Yeah, we're never off duty. Lifeguards for life. Yeah, absolutely. It's hard to take that out of you once you've trained for so long, you've worked so many years on the beach, you just never quite look at the ocean the same way.
And then you spent a lot of time over at Makapu. Tell us about your experiences there, because that's some... can be some pretty gnarly surf over there.
Yeah, Makapu kind of holds a fond spot in my heart. I've learned a lot of my lessons over there. And that can be one of the hardest rescues to make on the island over there. When the waves get big, it's kind of a cove, right? And it gets some of the strongest currents and most dangerous waves and shore break that we have anywhere on the island. Rescues can take over 30 minutes just to get someone back to shore. So I've worked with a lot of great lifeguards over there. I've been a lifeguard myself on Oahu for 20 years, and people like Kavika Eckhart and Pake Imhau and others that worked over in that location, just the knowledge I learned and the different conditions I got to experience while I was working with them was just priceless.
So I guess what's the underlying message that you have to beachgoers just about the vision for ocean safety and where you hope to take the department?
The underlying message is just we're going to grow. We're going to grow because I think we're in a space where we need to modernize a little bit. I think we've, I don't want to say stuck in the past, but we've been status quo for a while. Like things have gotten better, but I think there's a lot more to be done. And we can look at different technologies. We're talking about expansion of hours. I think you're just going to see more increase in our services, and our services will be better and enhanced by the different technologies and things that we're putting in.
We're talking like what, drones possibly?
Yeah, possibly drones. Yeah, drones, AI cameras. We're still using pen and paper in every single lifeguard tower to collect all our data and do our incident reporting, which then someone has to collect it. And then we have thousands and thousands of pieces of paper that have to be inputted into a computer and then filed away. So we're just something simple like putting an iPad in a lifeguard tower, and then we can then get real-time data, real-time reporting, and information sharing with all the lifeguards around the island.
As you look to expand the department, there's going to be a need for trained lifeguards. And I remember when my son wanted to surf, I said, okay, you can only surf, but you've got to promise me you're going to become a lifeguard because I want you to learn how to save yourself.
Yeah.
There had been some discussion with the Parks Department some years ago that they were going to allow students, I think 16 or under, to get jobs at the pools. But being a lifeguard in a pool is a little different from being on the beach.
Yeah, sure. You're talking about more of a static environment compared to dynamic. Some of the things overlap, but yeah, being an ocean lifeguard is quite different.
Any thoughts to expand the junior lifeguard program?
Absolutely. Yeah. The junior lifeguard program is one of my favorite programs that we have. And we get such positive feedback over that every year. We've, in the last 2 years, each year we've reached over 1,000 kids at different locations. So we're already in discussions for this coming year. We're looking at new locations on the island so that maybe we can serve areas that haven't been served before so that we can reach more and more kids. Yeah, we're definitely looking at expanding and growing that program. I think it's just one of the greatest things that we do.
Okay, yeah, we gotta expand the pool of lifeguard ocean safety officers.
Yeah, and if you went around and asked a lot of the lifeguards in the tower, a majority of them were junior guards at one point. It is a good recruiting tool, but at the very least, we're able to educate the keiki out there. And we've heard so many good stories of them making rescues on their own when they're out in the water or even at home helping their family members.
That was Kurt Lager, the city's new ocean safety director, who was the unanimous pick by the new Ocean Safety Commission. Lager is a 20-year veteran lifeguard and had been serving as acting director. A new exhibit entitled Ocean of Peace opened on Maui just before the holidays. It's a collaboration between the Maui Arts and Cultural Center, the East-West Center Arts Program, and the Pacific Islands Development Program. It features a half a dozen Micronesian artists and has been offering a number of programs to engage the community around the theme. We talked to Schaefer International Gallery Director Jonathan Clark, one of the curators, and Anthony Watson, a Palawan artist, about the stories behind the exhibit. Clark starts us off.
Yeah, so the Ocean of Peace refers to a diplomatic framework that rolled out in September of 2025 at a convening of Pacific Island leaders in Fiji. And the premise of this declaration is declaring the Blue Pacific continent as a region of peace and a space of harmony drawn from cooperation and traditional values. And you know, as a parallel to this larger diplomatic conversation, which often involves these like kind of lofty ideas, the exhibit is looking at the work of six artists of Micronesian heritage who hail from different archipelagos throughout Micronesia and interpreting many of those themes through their work, which really emphasizes like the humanity of it, the, you know, personal expression, the cultural stories that are inherent in each of their approaches to their work, and also building connection between Hawaii and Micronesia, because these six artists are currently based in Hawaii on Oahu, but their heritages are from throughout Micronesia.
And we have joining us Anthony. You know, talk about your work and how it fits in under this theme.
My philosophy behind my work has been to really absorb the various cultural influences around me, for not only from my own heritage, but from my surroundings. So I've lived in Hawaii for almost 23 years, and it has become, as the years go by, it has become a stronger theme in my work. And so I've suffused my own aesthetic with what I've gotten from Hawaii. And I just tried to sort of reflect that as honorably as I could. So even though I'm from Palau, I tried to have other voices and other aesthetics in my work.
And you work in wood and metal. And I just saw some pictures of your carving, the one out of lychee wood.
Yeah, that one was quite the process, the largest one that I've ever done. But that one was also aesthetically very informed by the history of canoe carving in Hawaii. And I milled with that also origin stories from Palau. And and then I tried to sort of weld those different histories together in that piece.
Well, when I think of Palau, I think of the Palauan storyboards and the artistry of all those legends telling that story through wood.
That's true. It's like this would actually be the first time that I've ever done like real bas relief carving that's sort of also in the same vein as Palauan storyboard carving, but I'm kind of trying to start my own thing over here. So yeah, it's I'm trying to forge a new path. But yes, that definitely, it does derive quite a lot from Palauan influences.
And Jonathan, talk about the variety of art that you're exhibiting with these different artists.
Yeah, so the six artists, they all work in quite different disciplines. And in the case of artists like Anthony, who are working in wood carving, those forms of art making have very long lineages, very long histories. We also have James Bamba, who is a master weaver, primarily working in pandanus weaving. But alongside that, we have, you know, other artists who are working in digital media, such as rendering and animation. So it's really quite a broad range of forms of work that pull from like these very, very historied art forms all the way to very new art forms. And I think it references the ancestry of these art forms and knowledge, but also pulls it into a very contemporary dialogue.
Well, I think, you know, when you go through Micronesia, each island group has a very strong identity. And so it's interesting to see, you know, what these artists bring to the table and how it, you know, is interwoven with their experiences living here in Hawaii. I don't know, how was it for you, Anthony, just about melding the two?
For me, it was kind of easier for me in that I've had these aesthetics sort of build up in me for quite a long time, and this exhibit is like one of the first times that I've ever sort of been able to sort of flesh out one of my main concepts, and I think that really just flowed out of me quite easily. But it's taken years of experience and just absorbing the culture here and sort of melding that with my own expectations about what an artist of my background should be doing in Hawaii. And I think this show has sort of honored my process and my presence in Hawaii.
We understand that two of your pieces have been nominated by the foundation as possible inclusion in the Art for Public Places.
Oh, yes, especially one of them was a canoe that I had carved, but then one of them is also these hairpins that were actually directly influenced by a film that I had seen on, I think it was PBS. One night I was just watching a PBS on TV, and I saw this reel of indigenous Alaskan fishermen using these salmon fishing spears. And I thought the shapes of it were very interesting, and I always sort of had this idea that I'd like to sort of meld indigenous art forms from the Americas and also from the Pacific. So there's a little bit of indigenous Alaskan influence, but then there's also Native Hawaiian weaponry influence, and there's also a Palauan lashing influence into that. And I just sort of brought them all together. And that for me was like such a rewarding experience, because I was sort of on the spot. I was just riffing on things that I've seen and absorbed, even on TV here. And it sort of helped me continue an idea that I've been pursuing for years. And so for me, that was very enjoyable that they actually nominated that one, because that's actually the one that I least assumed that the state would want. But at the same time, it's actually quite poetic, because it's sort of partially influenced by like public access TV, I guess.
Well, that, no, that's great.
That work.
It's great that, you know, it resonated with the judges. But Jonathan, then talk about the fact that this exhibit is going to be extended.
Yes, so this exhibit, it is running. It opened in early December here at Maui Arts and Cultural Center and got extended by a little bit and is running to the end of January. And so it'll be great after everyone has kind of resurfaced from the holidays for the exhibit to have a full month of exposure for the public to come through, and also that we've got several public programs happening throughout the month of January, including a screening of Remetal, People of the Ocean, including some of the folks who were involved with that film, as well as some of the artists with the talk story panel that accompanies the film. And then we also have an event, Activations, on January 16th, featuring performing artists with different iterations of Micronesian art forms in the gallery.
Okay, well, then it's a great opportunity for folks who haven't caught the show to be able to go there before the end of January. Anything else you want to underscore? It's free, right?
The gallery is free, and then both public programs are free. The film screening and the activations program do require ticketed reservations through the MAC box office at mauiarts.org. So if anyone is interested, we encourage them to reserve their tickets as soon as they can.
Okay, Ocean of Peace is the name of the exhibit, and we will make sure we get that information on our website. But thank you both for carving out time just to talk this up.
Yes, thank you very much, Catherine.
Yeah, and good luck. I hope that your stuff gets included in the Art for Public Places. What an honor.
Awesome. Thank you very much.
We have been hearing from Schaefer International Gallery curator Jonathan Clark and artist Anthony Watson. Other featured artists in Ocean of Peace include James Bamba from the Northern Marianas, Jillian Duenas from Guam, Carol Ann Carl from Ponape, Lizette Yamase from Chuuk, and Kalani Omenkar from the Northern Marianas and Palau. Look for links for more information on our website after the show. A stand-up comedian walks into a national park. It sounds like it could be the setup for a joke, but in 2023, Ben Miller became the first comedian in residence at Hawaii Volcanoes National Park. He met with park rangers and took in an active lava lake in Kilauea's Halemaumau Crater. And out of that experience was a one-hour stand-up comedy show about volcanoes that he's taken on a tour around the world. He spoke with The Conversation's Maddie Bender in advance of shows in Kihei, Hilo, and Kona. Here's a clip with the show.
Volcanic soil is extremely fertile, which I think is a hilarious prank. Like, come on, plant your crops, it'll be totally fine. Ignore that shaky mountain. And you ever really fell for that prank? Pompeii.
Were you a volcano kid? I know some people are like natural disaster kids, but when did volcanoes get on your radar?
Oh gosh. So I feel like very early on, I was really into rocks, had a rock collection, really into minerals, and then, yeah, probably left it behind maybe when I was like 8 or 9 years old. I mean, I always loved science, but to be honest, like, didn't really know much about volcanoes before I came out to Hawaii, so... Yeah, it was an incredible learning experience.
Well, walk us through how you became Hawaii Volcanoes National Park's first comedian in residence in 2023. How did that happen?
Yeah, so I saw it online and I was like, this seems incredible. And it said open to all artists. And I was like, there's no way they'd ever accept a comedian. So why don't I just throw in an application, see what happens? And yeah, they were extremely kind and generous and put me up for the residency. So yeah, immensely grateful that they took a chance on something they'd never taken a chance on before. Because, you know, normally it's like painters or like musicians or people have like won Grammys. And they're like, what about someone that makes jokes? Why don't we throw them into the mix? Yeah, I feel like whenever I'd say I was the artist in residence, they'd be like, oh, cool. So like, are you bringing like your paints? Like, where's your canvas? It's like, no, I just type out jokes on my phone. I'm sorry. So yeah, I met with like a bunch of park rangers who were extremely generous with their time, scientists that worked at the park service, met with some people at the Hawaiian Volcano Observatory, and yeah, just like explored the national park. I mean, when I was there in 2023 rather, there was an active lava lake every single night. So yeah, just got to see that, which is absolutely incredible. I mean, Paley's been incredibly active right now. So yeah, my joke writing process is generally just like gathering as much information as possible and sitting and thinking. It's not super exciting. It's not like, oh, I was struck by lightning and then discovered electricity or something like that. Yeah, it's just mostly learning and thinking and refining, I guess. You know, you think you have a joke and then you test it out in front of people and they're like, you do not have a joke. It's like, okay, I actually need to rewrite this, go back. I had a couple opportunities to test out jokes while I was there, but oh yeah, this is the other thing. For this residency, they want you to, at the end of this month, put on an hour-long show. And it takes most comedians like 2 or 3 years to write an hour of jokes. So yeah, a very particular challenge to, in 1 month, write a whole hour of jokes. I definitely said an hour of words. I don't know if they were all jokes, but since the residency spent a long time continuing to write jokes, refine them at like open mic shows at clubs like around New York City, and then started touring the show around the world. And yeah, super excited to bring it back to Hawaii.
So that 1 hour was basically an early prototype of what this show has turned into. And I'm super interested to hear about how it has changed over time. My understanding of your style is it's pretty rapid fire, joke after joke delivery. So was it as simple as just swapping out jokes that bombed with jokes that performed better? Or did you kind of undertake more of a structural edit of the show?
Definitely a little bit of both. Yeah, obviously there were jokes that were no good that I was like, okay, this is no longer in the show. But then there are also things where it's like, okay, I think there should be a joke about this, so I need to continue to work on this. And then also, like, as I've traveled and taken the show around, I've tried to like add new jokes based on like the areas that I'm going to. Like back in the spring, I went out to the Pacific Northwest. So I learned a bunch and like wrote some jokes about Mount St. Helens. Over the summer, as in the fall, I went around Europe, went to Iceland, so I wrote some jokes about Iceland. And then also one of the gaps in the show is like, I feel like I had to write a joke about space volcanoes. So that's one of the newer sections that I've added to the show. Yeah, so just a combination of like things that I think should be in the show, places that I'm going to, like I should probably write some jokes about their volcanoes because they'd appreciate that.
Do you feel like people relate to the show more when they have a volcano in their backyard?
Yes and no. I mean, I think definitely people that live around volcanoes have like a stronger inherent knowledge of what it's like. So for them, it's more like, okay, we're making jokes about this thing that like you have a knowledge of on a daily basis, you're used to interacting with or living around. But I think just inherently volcanoes are such powerful forces of nature that everyone is really excited about it. Like whether I'm doing the show in Portland right by Mount St. Helens, whether I'm doing the show in like Chattanooga or like Vienna where there are no volcanoes, like I think people are still very excited about it.
And as a comedian, how do you think about striking a balance between comedy and science? Is there a certain level of science that you feel like audiences are comfortable with? Does it all have to be in service of a punchline?
Oh, gosh, that's a great question. Yeah, that's something that I wrestle with all the time. I started comedy in New York City, and it's a very like grueling comedy scene where in the beginning you're getting like 3 minutes on stage. So if you don't like immediately grab people's attention, they're just absolutely the board. They don't care about you. There's a million comedians out there. So I think that definitely honed the style of have to be rapid fire jokes in order to keep people's attention. But also I do have a background as a scientist, so the science is important to me. But I think there actually can be like a really nice synthesis where like every joke is like set up punchline. And then if you have a fact as a setup, then you can have a funny punchline, and then you're getting both in the same package.
Do you have an example that comes to mind just to give listeners a sense of what you're talking about?
Oh gosh, this is going to be very disappointing for all the listeners and you, but I don't tell my jokes off stage.
Okay. Why's that?
I just laughed because I was going to say massive insecurity, but that's not entirely true either. I think jokes are very context specific. It's important to, you know, in the context of like, hey, we're at a comedy club. We're all here to laugh. Everyone's a little bit more primed for the joke. And then also, if it bombs, then the rest of this interview goes really badly. If I tell this one joke and it doesn't land for the people in the audience, they're like, we are not going to come see his show. He's a fraud. Everything he said has been a lie. I said I don't mind telling jokes for a small audience either in the context of the show. I've done the show for 3 people. I've done the show for 300 people. So that's a very long-winded way to let you down.
And I'm okay with that. But you brought this show to Hawaii last year. Any intentions for the performances or anything you want to do this time that you didn't get around to when you brought the show here last time?
As far as the performances, not really. Just excited to like share some new jokes about other volcanoes around the world and in space that I didn't have last time. Yeah.
Do you have an elevator pitch for someone who saw your show last year for why they should come out again?
There's 7 new minutes of material and it's been a year. You've probably forgotten it. It'll feel like new all over again. Or I don't know. You're welcome to stay home. I also respect that decision. There are a lot of people on Hawaii that haven't seen the show, so happy to perform for new people as well.
I think it'll be cool for them to know that, you know, a few years ago you were in Volcanoes National Park, and from that you have this stand-up show that you've been taking around the world for the past year.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I'm immensely grateful for the opportunity that the National Park Arts Foundation gave me, and for the National Park Service, Miss Everyone in Hawaii, and being so like generous with their time and their knowledge. Yeah, it was an immensely enriching experience just to learn about Hawaii, the history, the culture, the volcanoes, and I'm hoping to be able to at least capture a little bit of that in the show, be able to share it with people, hopefully get people like, yeah, just excited to learn more.
Okay, Ben Miller rocks. That was comedian Ben Miller and HBR's Maddie Bender. Miller performs tomorrow night at the Pro Arts Playhouse in Kihei at 7 p.m. He'll also be in Hilo and Kona later this week. Look for links on our website later today. Well, that does it for us today. Tomorrow, we plan to take a closer look at food security on the Big Island. We do welcome feedback. Call or talk back line 808-792-8217. Email us or post on social media. Find the conversation on our website or as a podcast on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.